Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. This young farmer is snowed in right next to Lake Champlain and talking to another young farmer who is in Southern California. I'm jealous of your weather, Owen.
I believe you.
Tell us what the weather is like over there. I think I have a lot of winter listeners here. Make us suffer.
Well, despite a recent sort of what would be described as a cold snap for this area, it over the last several days has warmed up quite a lot. And in fact, I believe today is just in the lower 80s Fahrenheit.
Okay, that'll do. Owen, you are a permaculture designer and landscape consultant and do workshops on key lining and holistic management and decision making, and you travel around the world as a consultant. What's that like as a lifestyle?
What that is like as a lifestyle is really, as you've described it, highly nomadic. And so, I've really been full-time at this a couple years now, but have been doing it since 2007. And so slowly, incrementally, since that time, it's just become more and more of a nomadic situation. So I'm getting in touch with that modality of sort of human lifestyles that have been going on, I guess, since the beginning of humans in one way or another.
So let's just do a quick review of some of these tools that you're using as you're going around consulting with landowners and land managers for water, for land health, for carbon in the soil, for permaculture design. Tell us what's in your toolkit and how you apply it.
Absolutely. Well, one of the sort of frameworks that I rely on heavily is the holistic management decision-making framework. And, of course, most folks are familiar with kind of the grazing planning aspects and livestock management that holistic management also brings to the table. But at the core, it's really a decision-making framework with a big focus on sort of generating a really positive vision for what you want in the whole that you're managing. And so that, you know, they refer to as the holistic goal or the holistic context now is the language that's being used around that. And, you know, that's really where I like to begin in any interaction with land and people is to find out what sort of that vision is and how we can then use the other tools, such as tools from permaculture design or from key line design. For example, the key line scale of permanence, which is climate, geography, water, access, forestry, buildings, fencing or subdivision, and soils, is more or less the sort of broad outline of a sequence that I use in doing designs. And other tools that I like to bring to the table there would include some sort of initial analysis using resilient science, which is sort of at the cutting edge of sustainability science that emerged in the last 10 or 15 years. And there are some good tools to sort of start to analyze where your particular system is at in an overall adaptive cycle. and that can give you good clues as to how to proceed. And additionally to that, I enjoy bringing in just, you know, being open to bringing in a variety of frameworks that have proven themselves to be useful in different scenarios, just because I feel like it gives a richer palette than if you're staying within any single kind of framework on its own. And so I like to bring in a lot of social group process types of tools and technologies, so to speak, where those are appropriate, because quite early on, that's one of the lessons that I got as early as 2007, I suppose, was that really the biophysical approaches and techniques that we bring to any of these land situations are, you know, only as good as, or really ultimately less important than what's happening within the social realm that's connected to that landscape. Because even if you have the best physical techniques in the world, they're not going to be applied, or they won't be consistently followed up on in a way that will support the land health in the long term if you don't have the social pieces functioning also.
So when people bring you onto their land to help them fix up their degraded land, how do you break it to them that they have social dysfunction problems, and then how do you work through that?
Well, that's a really good question. Yeah, I mean, it's not usually a situation where it's a matter of having to break this stuff to people, because usually when there are those problems or social dysfunction happening at a location, they're pretty well aware of it. And even if that's not where they're focusing, you know, because land and human systems are so connected and really ultimately can't be separated, as soon as you start talking about what the land issues are there, you're sort of already talking about the social issues that are connected to that, because usually it's like, well, we can't do this approach because of, you know, maybe it's kind of a larger scale regulation in the region, or maybe it's just a farm scale, you know, within the family or within the labor force or something. There is dysfunction. There's disagreement about how to proceed. So oftentimes it's not so much a matter of saying, well, you guys have to fix those specific problems, because that's another thing that they emphasize, or we like to emphasize in holistic management, is to manage for what we do want as opposed to managing for what we don't want. So it's much more of a sort of appreciative and a focus on sort of our vision on the solutions rather than on what the current problems specifically are. And because what we find is whether you do manage for what you do want or for what you don't want, you tend to get what you're managing for. And, of course, a great example would be just with the kind of national approach we have generally to sort of quote-unquote noxious weeds or invasives, that kind of thing. We spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year, you know, spraying for these things, and the problem just keeps increasing. So we're managing for what we don't want in that case, and we're getting it. Similarly, if we manage for what we do want, we find that can be very effective at achieving that too. So rather than telling them, people that, oh, here's your dysfunction and here's how you need to fix it, it's usually more just a matter of finding out from them what is your vision, and if there's disagreement around that, maybe going through a process to generate a holistic goal, holistic context, where the common ground can be achieved. And that's why those social tools can become really important in a situation like that.
And you you got all your training in land-grant university, is that right?
In fact, no. I do feel that our secondary education system has largely fallen down at this point and is You know, you might even go almost as far as to say irrelevant. So in a way, I use the fact that I did not, I don't have any kind of ecology or agriculture degree from any sort of land-grant university or other university as a positive, being that I have far less to unlearn as a matter of that being the case. So what my sort of university experience was also very nomadic, or what I'm calling my university experience in this realm, because of course I had the standard university experience, but it wasn't for agriculture or ecology. My undergrad was a cinema television production, which kind of those skills ultimately amount to storytelling. So I use that a lot as an educator now, those particular skills with graphics and with, telling a story in a way people can learn. And secondarily, my master's education was Eastern philosophy. So at first, when I was getting into this, I didn't recognize how deeply that connects to everything here. But really, it was the first kind of systems thinking or complexity awareness that was explored in a systematic way or in a tradition that humans have been doing. So I feel like that's really helped me to grasp a lot of these holistic frameworks that are applied to agriculture much more quickly than I might have been able to grasp them otherwise. And so subsequent to that, my sort of agricultural and social technology education has been kind of just a nomadic, free-range university, so to speak, where over the years I'll attend, workshops, conferences, experiences on farms and ranches doing different types of interning, and those kind of things wherever I can, that it's supplemented by an awful lot of reading and study ahead of time prior to, learning about those topics or subjects, and then more follow-up experiential and reading on the back end. And so that's more or less what I'm calling my sort of free-range university that has led to all of this.
It seems like there's kind of a cohort of you guys who are like the workshop teacher dudes, and you guys hang out a lot together, and you range around and get to see amazing variety of landscapes, and I like doing that too. I get to travel around a lot and look at different landscapes. But
it's wonderful.
One thing I always wonder about is the relationship over time with land, that land managers who are, more fixed in place are able to have and see really intimately the feedback loop of their, moves and the manipulations on that land and management decisions. How do you deal with that kind of weird problem of being a fly-in dude? What are you working on learning next that might help you do that better?
Sure. Well, and that's been definitely part of the journey in becoming increasingly nomadic, is kind of learning from that and, finding a way in to be able to, experience landscapes just in a visit with as much sort of intensity and accuracy, in terms of an assessment that will allow a really responsible design going forward. And that's certainly, I think, something that's going to be a constant learning process and, not something that's susceptible to perfection, like so many things in life that are complex. But one thing I have noticed is that I do get to have the experience of learning from all the folks who are living in those places, that it's their sort of territorial homes and that they understand the nuances very well. And so I get to learn from so many interactions with different farmers, ranchers, and land managers, maybe working for organizations that are managing land in one way or the other. So I sort of get to get some of that collective experience in the process, which really furthers my learning a lot. The other aspect of this is that while it is certainly true that staying on a particular piece of land for a longer period of time is going to give you much more nuance and sophisticated understanding of the details of what's happening. At the same time, I think it's been my experience that an understanding of the basic ecosystem processes, and this is another sort of approach or way of looking at the landscape that we teach in holistic management, is so the ecosystem processes are the water cycle, the nutrient cycle, community dynamics are kind of the successional level, or, you know, what is the collection of life forms that are here, and kind of what stage are they at in their assembly, so to speak. That'd be the community dynamics. And then fourth, it would be energy flow, and that, you know, basically just starts with sunlight, and it's kind of the thermodynamics of what's happening there. So the sunlight, you know, enters into that system, and it either it falls on bare ground or on a plant leaf, acting like a solar panel, which, you know, translates that energy into plants, and that gets translated into animals, etc., throughout creating the food web, in essence. So that's another ecosystem process. Naturally, all four of those processes are deeply interconnected. They're really a single process that the ecosystem is, you know, always becoming, so to speak. So, but they're just different lenses or different windows that makes it simple enough to understand what's going on in each of those compartments of the ecosystem, so to speak, although we understand that they're not compartments, it's a single whole. So my point being is that having those lenses, or having that way of approaching any landscape, anywhere I've been in the world, although the people at those different countries might be speaking different languages, the landscape is speaking the same language. And so it becomes much more effective to be able to read what's happening, the more you can kind of appreciate those kind of processes, in my experience.
Well, so many of us are operating at a farm scale, from a kind of farm scale perspective, and the farm and the kind of family farm is the basic, you know, economic movement, economic unit, I should say, of the local food movement or the re-regionalization project. But it sounds like the logic that you're tuning on into is more of a basin scale or a watershed scale, like landscape logic. What would be some tools that you would suggest for those of us who are wishing to kind of contextualize our own long-term decision-making, especially, you know, here in the Northeast, we've had major catastrophic weather situations with Hurricane Irene and Sandy, and, you know, people are really feeling, I think, more than ever the need to be resiliency-minded in their farm planning over the long term. What would be some good background or approaches that you would suggest for that?
Sure. Well, one of the ways when I'm working with folks to you know, help them flesh out the whole that they are actually managing on their farm property, ranch property, or you know, whatever land they might be connected to. And of course, you know, with the holistic goal and holistic context idea, you don't even have to own land, but, you know, the folks that I'm working with would tend to. So in any case, one of the tools that I use to do that is, I call it 3 by 3 equals 1, 3 times 3 equals 1. So basically, we look at three domains, that being sort of the ecological, the social, and the financial or economic. Looking at those three domains, we then take each of those and look at three different scales for each of them, because that's some of the things coming out of resilience science are showing, that you don't really understand a system until you understand what's going on at least three different scales and how those things are interacting. So, for example, our middle scale, our focal scale, so to speak, would just be the actual ecologically just the property boundary, so to speak, of the farm or the ranch. And so within that property boundary, who are the social players within that property boundary? What are the economics, within those social players? What's the economic, constraints and opportunities, that kind of thing. And then we'd look at a scale below the farm scale, which would be, say, the independent, ecologically would be the independent, say, land components, You've got maybe a riparian, a river system or stream, creek running through the property. That might be one kind of subsection, so to speak. You maybe have different fields that are managed differently, a pasture area, a forest area, whatever that might be. So you can break it down, those land areas that are within the focal scale, into their subcomponents. And then if appropriate, you can connect social dimensions to each of those, and or just break out the farm family into, the individual people that make up the farm family. That's the next scale below in the social domain, the focal scale, and likewise for financial. And then you can also look at the larger scale that property at the focal scale is embedded in. So it would be embedded in maybe a watershed or a larger community or bioregion. However, is meaningful for the client to define that for themselves, so it makes it a useful tool. They can look at what's happening in that system ecologically, socially, financially, and how that affects their farm. And a lot of times you can get just different insights about how your place is embedded and linked within this bigger system, and also to the smaller components within your system. So that's one tool that just helps us wrap our head around what it is we're actually able to influence and manage, and how that's connected to the larger scale above.
Well, and we don't always think that we can change. I really like the word, there's macro and there's micro, but I'm really into this word meso, that
right.
Feels like you
meso.
Are really articulating. And it seems like a lot of times we're not aware of how malleable that context really is, and how much it determines, how much those social relations determine. How do you get people on board, though? How do they, I know it's positive, and I know I've been through holistic management training, and I love it.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, people are ornery, People are locked in. especially old, old people. Let me apply this to, a little bit less abstract. One of the things I'm really absorbed with right now is around farmland transition and moving between the generations. So, about 70% of American farmland is owned by people who are over the age of 65. And, you see that everywhere across the country. You see people who are our parents' age who are owning businesses trying to transfer them to their kids or to somebody who's not their kids, or they're trying to sell it and have retirement. So it's like a pretty important negotiation point, like inflection point in terms of land management nationally, is getting on the same page on a meso level with people who, have institutionalized their own instincts in the farm business and on the farm land, and now have to deal with somebody else's instincts coming on board and shifting the way that translates out into land management decisions. Give us your top three ideas, Owen.
Okay. Somewhere in there, I lost the thread of what the ideas for what?
We might not even have time for three ideas. The ideas are about how to open up the conversation at all, especially with kind of recalcitrant players who maybe, especially in the generation who are in their 60s and late 60s and 70s, who still are the majority landowners. And especially in that transition, what are some good kind of basic tactics for young people who are in a kind of a negotiation around land with retiring generation people to open up the conversation about those the human systems and designing for transition.
Sure.
Wow, I actually repeated my question. Amazing.
Okay. Okay, well, I think that time I heard it more clearly, and thank you for repeating. I think, again, coming back to discussion around kind of what the vision is for that place and for what it contributes to the larger community can be, you know, one useful way to get into that discussion. Because, you know, leading from, I mean, that's, it takes a sort of position of listening to this, to the older generation and to, you know, what their thoughts and values are, regardless of whether you share them in every last instance. And but if you can understand where they're coming from with that and what it is that they need to satisfy their own sort of quality of life and vision for the future, then it becomes a lot easier, I think, to start to construct possible ways together that you can move forward towards that vision that also incorporates maybe a little bit different vision of the younger folks coming into that. But it's tough to get there without having that level of discussion. And I agree, sometimes not everybody wants to get into that dialogue. They just want things to be the way they are. And, you know, there's a certain amount of just the natural sort of human process of mortality that will also shift things, you know, just given the age differences there. Some of the more recalcitrant ones will only loosen up once mortality kicks in, in some cases. So that's, you know, not that that is a strategy. It's just kind of an observation of how things are to a degree. But, you know, I think if we can jump ahead of that, get out in front of that issue and not count on that as being the strategy, but enter into more of a dialogue, I think that's likely to be much more viable, and, you know, create solutions that integrate both interests. I really think that there's a lot of value to that. There's a saying somewhere that in a million voices, truth speaks. So I know younger people coming in have a lot of, you know, innovative ideas and the energy and enthusiasm to put behind them. But, of course, the older folks have tons of value to add to that situation. I think together, thinking this stuff through together, you're going to end up with a much better vision in the end, because it will have both the experience and the sort of innovative energy coming into it, rather than just
especially one-sided. For that to be a really reciprocal process, I feel like, and neither confrontational nor kind of win-lose or whatever antagonistic, is a real, you know, art and probably the goal.
Very much so.
And I think that it seems like the family is really the right tone to invoke. You know, to be in a kind of a loving place with each other. You know, I care about you being happy over the long term, and you care about me being happy over the long term, and start from a place that's more familial.
I think that's right. Family is a very powerful driver and container and sort of attractor for a lot of positive things, you know. There can be less positive things associated too, but I think, you know, on the whole, it's a very strong part of what human beings are and what they what we understand and how we kind of organize our lives. And if we can sort of not so much harness that, but work with that dynamic, you know, towards some of these more positive aspects, I think it can be powerful leverage.
All right, so powerful leverage and no more time. Treat your land like family and treat your non-family elders like family. find Owen online. He has amazing resume e-pictures and training classes coming up on keyline design and landscape management and holistic management and all sorts of amazing ninja tricks. Any last words before we say thank you?
Thank you, I think, is what I'll say. Thank you, Severin, for bringing me on. It's been a great pleasure.
Great pleasure to meet you, Owen, and thank you all for listening to another episode of Greenhorns Radio. Stay tuned for more later. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.